Yeah, guys, really cool to be with you this evening. I love South Africa, actually. I've been here a few times before, and any opportunity to come, I love it. I always thought if God hadn't seen fit to bless me with an Irish accent, then a South African accent would have been a pretty good next best thing. And the first time I came was as a schoolboy to play some rugby and got to tour around this beautiful country, Pretoria, Joburg, Cape Town, Durban, got to see it all. So I do love South Africa. I was involved in an incident at the top of Table Mountain back in 2007 when, as captain of the rugby team, I told the boys to kick balls off the top of the mountain just to see what they would hit. And luckily nobody was injured, but there's a confession to the people of South Africa for something I've done. But cool to be part of this dialog. Is that pronounced properly? Dialog. You've got to forgive me for that. I really like what you guys do here. I really like the idea of gathering around these big questions that there are to do with life and faith and Christianity and thinking whether or not there's anything useful that Christianity has to contribute to those conversations, whether there's any good news involved there, if there's any relevance, and just have an open and honest conversation. I just really like the sound of that. So I want to join in the spirit of conversation and discussion and just put a few things on the table for you guys to consider with this question of whether or not you can sit on the fence with Christianity. And we're going to have some Q&A towards the end, 15, 20 minutes of Q&A, where you can tell me, you know, how much nonsense I was speaking and all these points of disagreement. That's going to poke my eye out. That's all right. Thanks. Can you hear me better now, guys?
Yeah.
All right. And I guess with this question about whether or not we can sit on the fence, I suppose the spirit behind it, the why we've chosen this topic this evening is, as you guys come here week by week, and you think about these questions, and you consider the answers that Jesus and the Bible and Christianity would give to the big questions about life, and you compare those with the answers that other people would give, or the answers that you hear from other worldviews, the question is whether there comes a point in time, or kind of a fork in the road, where there is a decision to be made about those things, or whether or not it's possible to compare and contrast all your life and sit on the fence and never commit, have this kind of dispassionate, objective existence, whether or not that's sustainable in the long run. And if it were the case that a decision had to be made about these things, how could you do that in a reasonable way? You know, what would it look like to make a reasonable decision to follow this man Jesus or to choose not to follow him? What would that look like? And that's what I kind of want to base the majority of my comments around this evening, this sort of process of decision-making that we have and how we go about that in life. And then I've got a piece of poetry that I want to share. A piece of poetry, not something I've written, I must confess. I know, very disappointing. Maybe I should claim it next time. But actually, when I put it up, I'm going to say 50% of the room will recognize it, and I would not get away with that. And so I want to talk about this poem, which has kind of been floating around my own mind and heart for a few months, and I'll tell you why that's been, and I'll just put it on the table and we can talk about the poem together. But let's start with this process of decision making. I don't know what that typically looks like in your life and how you go about making decisions, big or small, whether it's what to eat for breakfast, where to work, who to date, who not to date. All of these things, some decisions are more important than others. You know, how do you go about it? Do you flip a coin? Do you draw up a list of all the advantages and disadvantages? Do you seek advice from friends or family? Or maybe do a mixture of all of those things? Decisions, they're not easy to take all the time. And we're keenly aware that as time goes past, I'll explain that in a minute, the decisions that we have a really big impact on who we are and who we are becoming as people, and where we're going in life. The decisions really matter. And you also know that sitting on the fence all the time isn't really an option either. And one of the funniest things I've read recently, I'm kind of a little bit into philosophy as a kind of a part-time interest, and the funniest things I've read in one of the philosophy books the past few weeks is about this thing. It's a story told by a medieval philosopher called John Buridan. And it's a story about John Buridan's ass. Not his derriere, but his donkey. And the problem that Buridan's ass has is that he's stuck looking at two piles of food. He's standing in the middle of two piles of food, and it knows that it should eat one of them, but it doesn't know which. It needs to make a decision about eating something, but it can't, or it won't, or it does not make a decision for one reason or another, and it ends up dying of starvation because it did not make a decision. And why I mention that is because when we consider the claims of Jesus Christ and the things which he said, it is very difficult to remain on the fence. We need to consider those very unique claims. There's much more on the line for our lives than you might first think. And the relevance that the potential for all of these claims on our lives might be. And if you were to sit on the fence in terms of Jesus and these claims that he made, what sitting on the fence would probably look like in this case would be saying something like, Jesus, you know, who's a very interesting historical figure, you know, maybe a very good moral teacher, someone who's definitely contributed quite a lot to the development of human society. Maybe you like the morals that are sometimes credited to Jesus' teaching. Maybe you put Jesus in the same league as people like Buddha or Muhammad or Gandhi. Maybe that's what sitting on the fence would look like, this kind of assessment of Jesus overall. But the thing is, Jesus can never be put in that league with the rest of those guys because he said things which were very much of a categorical difference. Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. That is not what Muhammad or Buddha or Gandhi said about themselves. Jesus set himself apart by that claim. And maybe the limitation of this analogy about Buridan's ass is the fact that it's not the case that we're choosing between two piles of food which are basically the same, but actually a bit of food over here and a bit of food over there, and they taste very different. They're full of very different content. Maybe that's the limitation there, and we need to deal with these unique claims that Jesus made. And just on the next slide, there's a really nice summary that C.S. Lewis gave about the situation. And he said, I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. In other words, no sitting on the fence. Now, getting to that piece of poetry that I mentioned, this is a poem called The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. And I'd say, have 50% of people heard of that? Yeah, a lot of nods. It's one that I came across for the first time. I studied it at high school. But it came flooding back to me just over Christmas past when I was reflecting on the roads and decisions that I've taken in life. Johan mentioned I had a former career working in finance, so I didn't always do what I'm doing now, working for RZIM. And I was doing pretty well in finance, to be honest. There's a lot of opportunity in London. The prospects in that career were good. And so to have left all of that behind is quite a profound decision in my life. It's really going to change the direction that things go from here on. So I was just reflecting on this, and I remembered about this poem, The Road Not Taken. And I got to reading a little bit more about the background to the poem. And the background is really interesting. It's all to do with Robert Frost's best friend, a man called Edward Thomas, who also happened to be a poet. There he is, you know, looking very artistic and reflecting on life's great issues. And Frost and Thomas, they used to go for walks together in the countryside. That was their kind of pastime and their hobby. And when they were out for the walks, Frost used to notice that when they came to a fork in the road, Edward Thomas would always sort of struggle to know which way to go. whether to the left or to the right, because what he always wanted to ensure was that he'd have, you know, the most interesting walk possible, you know, see the best wildlife, have the nicest views, you know, whatever it contributes to making an interesting walk. And if you got to the end of the walk and Thomas, you know, felt that it hadn't been overly interesting, he'd always be annoyed that he hadn't taken the other road. So Frost said that Thomas was a person, whichever road he went, would be sorry he didn't go the other. And so this is a metaphor for Thomas's life in general. It was actually around the time that the First World War was getting going, and Thomas, he couldn't decide in real life whether or not he should enlist to serve in the army. He wasn't massively patriotic, so it wasn't a no-brainer to him. He had a really big decision to make. So what do friends who are poets do to help their friends who are also poets to make decisions? They write each other poems. So that's the background to why Robert Frost wrote this Road Not Taken. It was a metaphor for this decision that his friend was taking at the time. And actually, they say that it was never supposed to make it into the public domain. They wrote it, Robert Frost wrote it to him privately, and somehow it escaped into the public sphere so that we could all study it. So we've seen it now, so let's go through it. Let me read this to you, The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, and let's see what we think. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller, long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay. In leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by, and that has made all the difference. Now, that is a really incredible poem, which I read about a million times over Christmas, just thinking about it and letting it reflect on me. And combined then with the research and the stuff that we know about the background, you can see the point that Frost is trying to make. He thinks our decisions in life are kind of like forks in the road when we're out for a walk in the country. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. It's a very nice idea. But the poem is very often misinterpreted. I wonder if you have just misinterpreted the poem. It's a very well-developed metaphor, but Frost is actually a bit of a cynic. He is actually being very critical of people that find it difficult to make decisions. The absurdity of sitting on the fence. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, yellow being the word often associated with being a coward. The lines in the poem which are most often misinterpreted are the ones right at the end. And again, in a kind of mocking way, Frost is pointing out that people very often say pretty much the same thing when they get to the end of their lives, regardless of what they've done. I've traveled my own unique path, and that's made all the difference. Apparently, the song which people request to have played at their funerals, at least in the UK, the song which is most popular is My Way by Frank Sinatra. No matter what type of life or what people have done, they always want to have this song played because everyone tends to feel the same way about their life, as if they've done this really unique thing. And Frost is wanting to come up against that sentiment and say that actually it's not usually the case. He's trying to go against the sentiment that we all lead these very unique lives, because he is very clear in the middle of the poem that he takes there to be no real difference between the types of paths that you might take. He says that both paths that morning equally lay in leaves that no step had trodden black. And the whole point is just that if we are out on a country walk, life is going to be sort of interesting one way or another. And Edwards, who's this guy trying to decide whether or not to join the army, should just make a decision. Because at the end of the day, whether or not he joins the army and has epic tales about what he did in the war, or he goes and has a wonderful career in poetry somewhere else, it's still going to be the case that in front of his grandchildren 50 years later, he's going to be telling them about how interesting a guy he was in any case. He's going to be telling them funny stories, acting like he had a unique life no matter what he did. It's just what people say. Now, the poem, when Thomas read it, did have a big effect on him. And he wrote to Frost shortly afterwards and said this: "Last week, I had screwed myself up to the point of believing I should come out to America, but I have altered my mind. I am going to enlist on Wednesday if the doctor will pass me." So that's what he did. The doctor did pass him, and Thomas enlisted in the army. But neither him or Frost expected what happened next. Just a few weeks later, almost immediately, unfortunately, Edwards was killed in the trenches of the front line. A young life cut very short, like millions of others in that war. And Edward Thomas would be telling no stories to no grandchildren about his life. The Road Not Taken is an awesome poem. It makes you think. But you can see here that this application to real life, that the message of the poem is not correct. Robert Frost was wrong. The paths we choose in life do make a difference. They do not lie in front of us equally. They lead to different places, take us on different journeys, and culminate in different destinations. In the case of Edward Thomas, he might have gone to America, and we'd be all reading maybe 200 of his poems in high school. But that's not what happened. He died in a trench. The paths we choose make a difference. And when it comes to Jesus Christ, what we make of his claims make all the difference in the world. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could. That's what you guys do here at Dialogue. You look at the answers to questions and you look at the alternatives and you see where they lead. And as we go through life, and as we come across the claims of Jesus and the answers that he gives to the questions we ask, we need to decide whether we will go down that path. But what would that decision look like? How could you make that decision reasonably? Where do you go from here, this point of a crossroads or whatever you want to call it? Now, whenever you consider the claims of Jesus, these things about him calling himself the Son of God and the various things that you guys discuss week by week, it might be the case that it's all new to you. Stuff that you haven't heard before, it's a little bit unfamiliar. Maybe a little bit weird, if we're going to be honest. It's not everyday stuff which comes up. And maybe it's the case that Jesus has been a stranger to you before now. Albeit he sounds like maybe quite a nice stranger, somebody you might like to get to know, but you've got so many questions and lingering doubts and different things that you're working through. And I want to say very clearly that that's cool. That is normal, and that is absolutely right and reasonable to be in that position. There's nothing weird about having questions. It's right and good to wonder about these things and to work it through and to dialogue and to have conversations. I think actually, coming across Jesus is a little bit like coming across a stranger, you know, at a party or in a nightclub. Someone you're slightly attracted to from across the room. And you feel maybe a little bit drawn to them. Maybe you get their number and you meet up a couple of times. And you find that there's something really attractive about this person. You like them. And maybe it's the case that you're slowly being wooed towards them, maybe slowly falling in love with the person, but the doubts kick in. You're a commitment phobe, and you don't know whether or not you can really trust this person. You wonder, is there a dark side to their character, something you haven't seen yet? Or if you're someone that struggles with self-esteem, maybe you ask yourself the question, well, what is it that Jesus sees in me? You're attracted to them, but you have doubts. And in that situation, you've got two options. You could hold back and become a prisoner of your doubts and your hesitations. But you know that if we did that all the time and kept on sitting on fences, you'd miss out on so many of life's great adventures, which might include falling in love and potentially discovering the Christian faith. But on the other hand, you can make a decision and say something along the lines of, I'm going to give this a go. I do have questions, but I can work those out as I travel on down this road. And it's exactly this kind of latter, you know, that second description of a decision, option two there. That's exactly the kind of decision which the Bible has in mind when it describes what it really means to have faith and to follow Jesus. And that is really like how we tend to exercise faith in the rest of normal life. But if you go out there and you ask people on the street, what is it that it is to have faith? You'll come across all sorts of other ideas and what I would say are misconceptions about what the Bible means by faith. And one of the things that is most often said, at least that I come across, is that faith is kind of like a psychological crutch, a thing which is sort of made up to give weak people something to limp through life. And, you know, a set of fairy stories to believe in which kind of just make them feel better about themselves. And that's exactly what Sigmund Freud used to say, the psychoanalyst based in Austria in the 20th century. Now, I don't have the time to go into sort of all the detail about that particular objection, but let me cut to the chase. Freud is completely missing the point. The reason why people might have faith like a crutch is completely distinct from the question of whether or not the content of the faith is true. What we need to do above all is review the evidence and ask ourselves whether or not the psychology of the believers has really got any relevance to what is or is not the case. We need to establish on purely logical grounds whether or not the content of the faith breaks down as a concept. And after that, you can, if you have the appetite, you can go and study the psychology of why the people started to believe in something that was wrong. But the issue of why people believe is completely distinct from what they believe. And at the end of the day, if Christianity is false and we're intellectually honest, even if we could do with a crutch in life, we won't want to believe it. But if Christianity is true, that same intellectual honesty should command our belief, even if we don't need a crutch to get us through. The Christian faith is founded on evidence, but curiously, that's exactly the opposite of another big objection that you would hear. People will often say that faith is the embracement of some kind of irrationality, a belief completely in the teeth of evidence. That's the exact words that Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, a book which you might have read, Dawkins defined faith as blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence. Now, did you hear the story about the person that used to come to Dialogue and they decided to have a career change, left South Africa and became a magician on a cruise boat in the Caribbean? And working as a magician on the cruise boat in the Caribbean, this person decided that because the audience would be different every week, they could get away with performing the same tricks week by week. They could do the same tricks every time. The only problem was that after a few weeks, the talking parrot, which belonged to the captain of the boat, started to shout out things during the show which were very inconvenient. He started to notice what was going on. So the talking parrot would say things like, "Why are all of those cards the aces of spades? That is definitely not the same rabbit you put into the hat. I can see you hiding those flowers below the table." So the parrot was making a bit of a nuisance of himself. But that night, the ship struck an iceberg and began to sink. And the talking parrot and the magician find themselves clinging to the same piece of wood. And they looked at each other with hatred. But they were struggling to stay afloat. And after a few hours, the parrot finally said, "Okay, that's a good one. What have you done with the boat?" So the parrot knew full well that the magician had no real magical powers, but was prepared to believe, against all sorts of evidence to the contrary, that there was going to be a boat which came to carry them to safety. And that is what so many people think the Christian faith is like. But the Bible and the New Testament know nothing of the sort. The word which is used for faith in the Bible is a Greek word. It's called pistis. And pistis is all to do with what it means to be rationally persuaded to put our trust in something, and specifically a person. What it means to put your trust in a person. So if I say to you, "Hey, meet me at 5 o'clock, and you come along at 5 o'clock, because I've never let you down before, I'm always there at 5 o'clock. You come and there I am," you've just demonstrated pistis. You thought, "He's a trustworthy guy, I'm going to go meet him." And luckily that I did, he bought me an ice cream. And so pistis is the kind of faith we exercise all the time. Pistis is what you did when you came here this evening. You heard the meeting was starting at 6 o'clock. The guys are usually there at 6 o'clock. You think they're trustworthy. You've heard them talking about it. "I'm just going to go there." And right enough, here we are. It's all okay. I may or may not buy you an ice cream at the end. And going back to that person at the party, pistis is what you do when you decide to enter a relationship with that person. You've been rationally persuaded that they love you. And you've seen that there are some pretty good reasons to love them back. And maybe you decide to get married. And standing at the altar, taking your vows, there are so many things you haven't yet found out about that person. But standing at that moment in time, it is rational for you to put your trust in them and walk the road together as you work through the rest of the questions and the doubts that you might have. Now, I don't know if any of you have Bibles with you or Bibles on your phone. If not, don't worry, it's going to be on the screen. But if you open up to John chapter 14, this is a bit where Jesus is himself describing what it would be like to follow him. And he's talking about the path that he wants us to get to and how we might get there. So John chapter 14, this is Jesus speaking. He says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." The Bible says repeatedly that God has chosen and has loved each and every one of us since before the world began. He loves you, and there is room for you in his house. Room for everyone, no matter who you are, where you've come from, or what you've done. There is room in the Father's house for every single person. But the thing is, to want to be in the Father's house, it kind of makes sense to want to know the Father, to have a meaningful relationship with him. But the thing about meaningful relationships is that for those to work, love has to be freely given and freely received. And we know that God has freely given his love to us. That's what we see when we think about Jesus on the cross. It's very clear that God cares deeply for us and loves us. But it's the case that we haven't always wanted to receive that love. It might be the case that in the past, in your life, or even right up until this very present day, you haven't wanted to receive that love from God in your own life. That's why it is the case that Jesus feels a little bit like a stranger at a party. We haven't had a relationship with him up until this point. And if we're far away from God, the question becomes, you know, how can we get back? How can we get to the Father's house? Well, Jesus is saying here that he has prepared a place for us all and that he's made it possible for us to get there by following him, the Son of God, the one who's come from God, knows God, and knows how to get back to God and can take us with him. We can follow Jesus all the way to the Father's house. The things that we've done wrong in our lives and the damage we've done to our relationships and the people around us, and especially our relationship with God, it's serious damage. And when damage is done, there's always a price to be paid. It's not like God is naive to that. Let me tell you a story about when I was a little boy and used to play soccer in the back garden with my brother. I was a Man United fan, so I'd want to be David Beckham. He was a Chelsea fan, so he'd want to be Frank Lampard. And the thing which those two players have in common is that they're both pretty good at free kicks. So we just invented a game to help us with our own target practice. 10 points for a direct hit to Dad's satellite dish. Yeah. 5 points for a hit to the living room window. And 1 point if you could just get one of the pieces of bed linen that Mum had hung out on the clothesline. Other rules, standard protocol, if you kick it into the field next door, hitsies, getsies, you know, everyone knows that. Now, I don't know how much damage you think it's possible for a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old to get through in an afternoon, but if you were to ask my father, he would give you a pretty good answer. I think the final score in the game was something like 70 points to 55. You know, a completely mangled satellite dish, 2 broken windows, and some pretty difficult stains to remove from that lovely white bed linen. Now, how can the mess in our lives be dealt with? When stuff goes wrong, someone has to pay. Shattered glass, mangled satellite dishes don't fix themselves. Neither do shattered lives. And the restoring of relationships depends on the guilty party saying sorry. My brother and I were very sorry. We promised never to play in that part of the garden again, and we were very much reformed characters from that day on. But someone still had to pay the price to fix the damage of what we'd done, and it wasn't going to be us. My pocket money was £3 a week. I don't know what that is in rand. And if I ate my vegetables and my mushrooms, my onions at dinner, I would sometimes get an extra 50 pence. That, no matter how much you're going to save up, is never going to pay for a satellite dish to be fixed. So in order for the relationship to be restored to my father, someone had to pay, and it had to be him. So it is with our Heavenly Father. He loves us so much that he sent his son Jesus to die on the cross and pay the debt that we could never pay in our own lives. It's an amazing gift, something offered to us all, and it's on offer even this evening. Jesus allowed himself to be killed on that cross, and the damage and the shame and all the consequences of all the nonsense that has happened in our lives was poured out on him instead of us. It's an incredible transfer of status. We who were guilty before God are declared innocent, and he who is innocent took our punishment. But I've said that meaningful relationships depend on love being freely given. We've seen that. But the other side of it is that meaningful relationships need love to be freely received. Do you think it's the case that Jesus is potentially knocking on the door of your life tonight? And whether or not you're on the fence, but you think you might need to get down and follow him along that path, Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could. You know, if you feel like you want to get off the fence this evening and start on that journey, that path of following Jesus this evening, then come and have a word with me afterwards, and I can tell you what you might like to do, a prayer that you might want to pray. But if you're feeling that, actually, I'm still going to stay on the fence for a little bit longer, I do have questions, that's cool as well. I want to encourage you to keep thinking and to keep coming back and having these very, very important conversations.